Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders about their experiences, their insights, and their aspirations. I'm Rashini Rajkumar. In today's episode, CEO Glenn Gunderson chats with Tony Dungy, iconic NFL coach and former NFL player, who became the first Black head coach to win a Super Bowl. Find out what's even more important to Tony than his 2007 Super Bowl victory.
Well, Tony Dungy, it is such a pleasure to be with you. I am honored for you to be a guest here. And frankly, I've been admiring you for a long time as a leader for good. And one of the things we share is a faith, and that has been so inspiring to see how you've led through your faith. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about your upbringing in Jackson, Michigan, and what that was like as a young person, and then we'll carry from there.
Well, Glenn, I think I got the best upbringing that anyone could have. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Grew up in a little small industrial town. Everybody kind of took care of everybody else. A lot of people were related in some way or another, but it was an automotive town. My parents, however, happened to be teachers. My dad was a college professor. He taught junior college biology and science. My mom was a high school English and Shakespeare and public speaking teacher. So education was really important in our house. But more than that, I think they gave us a background in how the Lord wants you to work, that life is more than just where you worked or what you did. It was really who you are and how you carried yourself. My mom was the Sunday school teacher. My grandfather was a Baptist minister. Two of my dad's brothers were ministers. So I heard the stories. I got the background early on, but I also got to see people who lived that out and showed me the right way to go. And my parents were just, they were my heroes, and they'd remain that way.
I also grew up in a small town to a couple of educators. So I love that shared history as well. What for you was it like growing up as a young Black man? How much did race show up in the conversation within your household?
You know, it was really interesting. When I was born, we lived in a predominantly white neighborhood, white area of Jackson. My dad, when I was in third grade, he wanted to finish his PhD work. So we moved on the campus of Michigan State University. That was multicultural then. We lived in the married housing. We had people, foreigners. We had people from all over there. And so you didn't really think anything of it. I had friends of all different backgrounds. Well, then when I was in sixth grade, I moved back to Jackson. My dad continued his teaching. And now, for the first time, I realized I lived in an all-Black neighborhood. And this was in 1967, 1968. We built a new high school. People from my neighborhood got bused out to the new high school, which was predominantly white. And that was really my first experience with we and they and, you know, divisions and that kind of thing. And it was really strange. And, of course, my parents had taught me just the opposite, that everybody's the same. You treat everyone like you'd want to be treated. And then 2 years later, two springs later, Dr. King is assassinated and everything's going on. It was a difficult experience growing up. I do remember as a very young boy watching on a little small black and white TV with my dad. And these two African-American students were trying to enroll at the University of Alabama. And George Wallace was the governor at the time. And I remember watching with my dad and him saying, we'll never have Negro students, is how they called it back then. We'll never have Negro students at this school. And I remember asking my dad, what's going on? What is this all about? And he said, well, there's some places and some people who aren't going to like you because of what you look like. But for us, we don't do that. We don't buy into that. And I don't ever want you to think that way. And those were my earliest memories. And fortunately, I had parents that taught me the right way.
Do you recall as a young person when Martin Luther King was killed, assassinated? I think I've read that you had some conversations more deeply with your father, Wilbur, at that point. Can you share a little bit about that?
I remember the day it happened, like it was yesterday. I was 12 years old. I'm living there in Jackson, and I've kind of started to experience this and, you know, people talking black and white and knew who Dr. King was. And I remember watching on television the reports of his death in Memphis. And I remember walking around saying, that is so sad. And hearing people say they killed him, they shot him because he was black. And then some of my relatives living in Detroit calling my dad and saying, gosh, there's everything going on. This neighborhood's on fire. This is on fire. And it was just so hard for a young boy to picture that. But my mom and dad saying, hey, when you do the right thing, when you stand up for the Lord, everybody's not always going to like it. And you are going to get attacked in certain ways. And that's why Dr. King was attacked, for doing the right thing. And if you are going to be attacked, you want to be attacked for doing the right thing, not the wrong thing.
You know, your parents were pioneers throughout your family. And certainly you follow on with some amazing pioneering of your own. But your dad's involvement with the Tuskegee Airmen is something I had a chance to dig into a little bit. You reflected on in one of your books. Would you share how you learned about that and what you have come to understand since?
Yeah, it's totally, shocked. And I can put all the pieces together now that I know what happened. But my dad, I knew he was in the service. He had talked about enlisting. And so I knew that. He graduated from high school in 1944. So I knew it was around World War II. But that's really all I knew. And there were times when I would say, growing up later, say that something was unfair, or the teacher didn't give me the right grade, or the coach didn't get me in, or the quarterback didn't throw me the ball. You know, something is not fair. And anytime I would say that, my dad would always say, well, life isn't always fair. There was a time they didn't want us to fly, so we had to teach ourselves. Yeah. Sometimes you have to teach yourself to fly. And I knew what he was getting with that. Hey, you can complain, you can be in the tank, or you can work on doing something to make it better. And that was always his thing. How are you going to make the situation better? So I knew that. I knew he was in the service. I knew he talked about teaching yourself how to fly. But it wasn't until his funeral in 2004 that a gentleman stood up, that people were talking about him, and this gentleman said, yeah, we're so proud of Will Dungy when he went into the Air Force and joined the Tuskegee Airmen. And my sister and brother and I just were like, what? That's what he was talking about all those years. That's what he meant about teaching yourself to fly. And then we got some memorabilia and we saw some pictures of him, and it was so stunning. But he it wasn't something he talked about a lot. He wasn't a braggadocious guy. As a matter of fact, Lovie Smith, who worked with me in Tampa for many years as our linebacker coach, he used to talk to my dad every Friday at practice. And when someone told him my dad had a PhD, he said, I've known your dad for 8 years. I've never heard anybody refer to him as Dr. Dungy. And I said, he just never did call himself that. He didn't think introduced himself as Will Dungy. And that's the way he was. And he said, do you know how rare that is, you know, African-American PhDs at that time? And I said, yeah, I do. But I never had any idea about the Tuskegee Airmen until his funeral.
You know, that must be where you got some of that humble servant leadership. What a great story and a great lesson, I think, for all of us, right, to think about how do we serve without that desire to be honored or recognized in return. And yet you were recognized and honored. You were a great high school athlete, and you come to the University of Minnesota, and I appreciate, Coach, those colors that you're wearing today as a lifelong Golden Gopher fan. In fact, I can attest that in 1975, I think it was late November, I attended my first ever Golden Gopher football game with my grandfather, who was a 1941 Golden Gopher graduate. And you were on that field doing some amazing things. So I can say that you're one of my first heroes as a young, aspiring athlete. What was it like coming to the University of Minnesota at that time? And how did race show up there? I would imagine the dynamics were quite interesting, perhaps coming from Jackson to Minneapolis.
Well, it was, and even the journey to get there. I grew up, I was always kind of in a leadership role. I was a shortstop on the baseball team, point guard on the basketball team, quarterback. That's all I'd ever played. Well, I start to get recruited now by different colleges, and I'm starting to visit different places, and some of the players, African-American players, are telling me, make sure they're recruiting you as a quarterback. There are some places that aren't going to have you play quarterback, and that's what I am. I don't know how to play anything else, and surely I've got to be a quarterback. But then as I started to see it, Minnesota was different. Minnesota had a history of African-American leadership. Sandy Stevens, one of the reasons I went to the university, Sandy Stevens in the early 60s, African-American quarterback, led them to a national championship, Heisman Trophy finalist. And there was no question that I was going to play quarterback in Minnesota. Other places you didn't know. And this was in the early 70s. So that was one of the reasons I chose the university. I got there, and it was a different, again, perspective for me. Huge campus, multicultural, big city. My eyes were wide open coming from a little small town in Michigan.
No, I'm sure. And what was that experience like, playing for Cal Stahl probably in those years?
I did, yes. Coach Stahl had been at Michigan State, not too far from my hometown. Duffy Doherty, as a matter of fact, was one of the pioneers of integration of football. Duffy had good friends on his coaching staff in the 60s that coached in the South. And people would tell him, this is a great player here, but our school can't recruit him. I can't recruit him at North Carolina. And so you better take him. And, of course, Minnesota had that history as well with Murray Warmoth, the same way he had come up from Tennessee, and he's getting guys, Bobby Bell from Shelby, North Carolina, you know, who couldn't go to the University of North Carolina at that time but becomes an All-American at Minnesota. So Coach Stahl, he had a rich history, and he's talked about building a legacy, and he talked about being uncommon, and that's something I never forgot. The very first meeting we had as freshmen, said, you can come here, you can be a C student, you can be an okay athlete, you'll get through, you'll have your scholarship paid for, and you'll be just okay if that's what you're looking for. I'm not looking for that. I'm looking for people who want to be uncommon. I'm looking for people who want to be A students, who want to be Big Ten champions, who want to help Minnesota win a national championship. So you can do that by having exceptional talent, be gifted in a way that God has given you something that many other people don't have. Or you can be uncommon by having a drive and a desire that allows you to do things that everybody else could do, but most people won't. And I'll never forget that. That was 1977, or 1973, I'm sorry. 1973 as a freshman. And I wrote that down in my notebook. If that's what it takes to be uncommon, drive, desire to do what everybody could do, but most people won't. That's me. And I think that kind of described my career at Minnesota. I love working out. I love being a leader. I love working as hard as I could. I wanted to graduate. Jim Brewer was a great basketball player in the early 70s, number one draft choice in the NBA. He'd just come back from the Olympics. And he talked about getting a degree and graduating in 4 years and not wasting your scholarship. And I said, that's me. I want to do that, number one, and I want to help Minnesota win a national championship. We didn't do that, but that was my drive and my desire, and that fueled me in the years I was there.
Hmm. You know, very few black quarterbacks at that time in the college ranks, if you know, certainly if not in the NFL. What was that like? What was your experience as a quarterback in those days?
Well, fortunately, Minnesota, again, it wasn't rare. It had been done before, so nobody looked at it that way. I didn't realize it, but around the country, it was looked at differently. And I can remember a game my senior year in college. We played at the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. I was quarterbacking the Gophers. I was leading the Big Ten in passing. And Washington had a quarterback by the name of Warren Moon. He was leading the Pac-8 at that time in passing. We played, and people were just astonished. These two quarterbacks throwing, African-American quarterbacks, and it was a big story. We didn't think too much of it at the time. My career ended up that year. I didn't get drafted. People said, you can go to the Canadian League and continue to play quarterback, or you can go to the NFL, but it'll require a switch of position. Something inside me, I know it was the Holy Spirit now, but something just said, hey, I want to go play with the best. So I had a chance to go to Montreal in the Canadian League, but I went to the Pittsburgh Steelers. I switched to safety. And the next year, Warren Moon came out. He was faced with the same choice. He went to Canada and played quarterback for Edmonton, won 5 Grey Cups, and became a Hall of Fame legend after he returned to the NFL. But for so many African-American quarterbacks at that time, that was the choice. Mm-hmm. Switch positions and stay in the NFL or go to Canada and continue to play quarterback.
Yeah, interesting. So did you ever regret not going up to Canada and doing that, or was that transition to the NFL the right one?
Sometimes, you know, you have that twinge. I wonder if I could have done what Warren did. If I went up there and played 3 or 4 years and lit it up, then I could come back and shown what I could do. But for me, it was really God's hand, I think, taking me to Pittsburgh. I ended up playing for Chuck Knoll. We won a Super Bowl during the time I was there. He brought me back on the coaching staff. I got traded twice during my career, once to the San Francisco 49ers, Bill Walsh's first year. And so I played on the championship team in Pittsburgh. I saw Coach Walsh build a championship organization in San Francisco. I'd been an offensive player my whole life. I switched to defense, learned that side of the ball in the pros, and then I got a chance to come back on Coach Knoll's coaching staff for 8 years. He hired me when I was 25 years old. So I do know that God had a plan, but every now and then, especially when I'm around Warren, then I say, yeah, I wonder if I had done that, maybe I could have had that same career.
You know, I mentioned earlier you as this leader for good. Who were the leaders for good, maybe aside from your parents, that really had an indelible impact on you and maybe helped drive you down this pretty remarkable leadership path?
Well, a lot of men in Jackson growing up, a lot of guys who were 5, 10 years older than me, looked over me like a little brother and guided me, and I had some great mentors there. Coach Stahl was certainly a valuable part of my life. Tom Moore was my quarterback coach at the University of Minnesota. And then later on, we ended up coaching together with the Steelers on Coach Knoll's staff. And then Tom was my offensive coordinator with the Colts when we won the Super Bowl. And he was instrumental. Matter of fact, Tom came and got me when I was a high school senior and rode with me on the plane. I'd never been on a plane before when I took my visit to Minnesota, and I was afraid actually to get on the plane. He said, I'll come back and sit with you. So we've had a special relationship over the years. And then I got to the Steelers, and Donnie Shell ended up being my roommate. Coach Knoll put me in with him. He was a strong safety, great player. He'd been there 4 years. Coach said, you don't know a lot about defense. Stick with Donnie. He'll help you. He'll help you grow. And he did. He taught me about the game and the playbook. But more than that, he was just a dynamic Christian athlete. He was on fire for the Lord. And being in the dorm room with him, being in the hotel room on the road, watching him, learning from him how to be a man, how to be a husband, how to be a father, how to be a teammate, it was really, really special.
When you matriculated up through those roles in the coaching ranks in the NFL, and then you get your first head coaching job with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, what was the reception like for you taking that job on, and how did the locker room respond? And, you know, that was a franchise that needed some retooling at the time. Talk through that experience.
Well, I had, coached at, started at a very young age, coached 8 years in Pittsburgh. Then I went 3 years to Kansas City. Now, by this time, I'm in my late 30s. We've had some pretty good defenses. And people are saying, just maybe this guy's going to be a head coach. And then in 1992, I come to Minnesota with Denny Green. And I'm coordinating the defense. In 1993, we had the number one defense in the NFL. And people are saying, gosh, if there's anybody who's ready to be a head coach, it's this guy. And I start getting interviews, and I'm finishing second every time. And people are saying, what is it? And a lot of people attribute it to race. They're just not ready for a black head coach. But I think for me, it was more of my personality, my demeanor, my Christian faith. A lot of owners at that time didn't think a mild-mannered, soft-spoken person could control these 47 high testosterone behemoths. And they didn't have confidence that I could do it. I think more so than race, for me, it was that stereotype. Well, 1993 goes by, 94 goes by, 95 is going, and at the end of the 95 season, I got a chance to interview in Tampa. And Tampa had a bad history, a long time losing. They had a tough racial situation with Doug Williams. He was their quarterback under John McKay, led them to the playoffs, and then in a salary dispute, they didn't pay him. And many of the black community just said, oh, this is racism. And they kind of turned off on the Bucs at that time. So the Bucs were losing, didn't have a lot going in the black community. And I interview there, and I'm not their first choice. Jimmy Johnson had just left Dallas. He'd had a dispute with Jerry Jones. He was from Florida. He'd been very successful at the University of Miami. That's who they wanted. Well, he went back to Miami and went to the Dolphins. Their next choice was Steve Spurrier, very popular coach at University of Florida. He had played for the Buccaneers, very glib guy, media loved him. He was their second choice, and he stayed at Florida. So now they're working on, gosh, we got to pick up the pieces. We didn't get the two guys we wanted. Who can we get? And I ended up being the third choice. And a lot of people, I think, thought at the beginning, well, this is the third choice. This isn't the guy we really wanted. So the reception from the fans was a little just lukewarm. But from day one, the players, the administration, people inside the building, total support. It was a great situation. And I had fun there. Stayed there 6 years, got to the playoffs for the first time in a long, long time. We were a couple of plays away from the Super Bowl. And had some great young men. So it was a wonderful experience.
And you move on to Indianapolis, and that experience culminates with a world championship, a Super Bowl championship, and that had to be quite an incredible experience, and it's been well documented. What was the inspiration for you to move on from coaching? You're somebody who I hear from many say, wow, he could be coaching today, just that great vitality and energy and passion. But what was the inspiration to make a pivot?
Well, I started so young. And so by the time we won our Super Bowl there, I'd coached 26 years. And so I'd done it a long time. And I just kept having this thought, there's got to be something more that I can do. How can I really pour more into my community? When I'm coaching, I'm definitely pouring into these 53 young men. I can do some things in the community, but I've got so much time invested right there in the stadium at the building. There must be more. And so I was, I think 53 years old. And I did get into some community work in Tampa, the All-Pro Dad organization that I'm very proud of. I got to work with a community outreach that reaches out to ex-offenders and prisoners and inmates. Got a chance to do things with that. Speak for the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. Different things that I felt like I could impact my community a little bit more than just coaching football.
You know, one of your adopted homes in Minneapolis, we went through it, right, in the summer of 2020, and with the murder of George Floyd and all of the racial reckoning and social justice reckoning that has really continued with Minneapolis being that global epicenter for the dialogue. What was your thinking when George Floyd was murdered? Did it surprise you? Where are you now? And where do you think we are as a culture now in terms of really bringing equity to the fore? And I'm particularly thinking about this as a leader at the Y.
Yeah, no, as a culture, we've got a long ways to go. I was heartbroken and I was really shocked because that wasn't the Minneapolis that I remember. That wasn't the Twin Cities. I was just stunned to hear the stories and people saying, well, this is not an isolated incident. This isn't rare. We've got this friction here. And I've visited the Twin Cities in the last 20 years, but hadn't really lived there and spent a lot of time since I left the Vikings. And I just didn't remember it being that way. And so I think we've got a big job. We've got to come together. And as my dad would say, what are we going to do to make the situation better? It's easy to complain and say, this is wrong. This is wrong. This is not the way it should be. But I've got to be an agent for making things right, for helping out, for bringing that dialogue and bringing that understanding together. And I think that's where we are as a country right now.
Yeah, I think it's a strong encouragement. You know, we all can do more, right? And a big part of it for us at the Y is trying to pour in cultural competence and equity leadership perspectives into our young people, our families, our seniors, really all in our community. And so I guess I would ask a couple more questions. One is, how do you look to organizations like the YMCA, and what would you be looking for from me? I'm a middle-aged white leader, and what are you counting on from leaders like me?
Well, I'll tell you, one of my fondest memories growing up was playing basketball at the Y when I was 9, 10, 11 years old in East Lansing, Michigan, and going there and playing and not recognizing this guy's black, this guy's white. We're playing basketball. And it was a place that you could go and have fun and enjoy. And I think they taught that, hey, this is what life is about. It's teamwork and working together and improving and growing. And I think that's the message that we have to get across. And I think as a leader at the Y, don't feel restricted. Don't think, well, I'm only this. I'm a white guy, so I don't know. What it's about is teaching people how to work together and teaching people that everybody's the same. And I think the Y is one of the great places to learn that.
Tony, you've really exhibited some impressive leadership as a dad. And I'd love for you to speak about your role as father, you and your wife getting involved in adoption as well. Just talk about your role as a dad.
Yeah, my dad and my mom were so special in my life, and I really feel like that's my number one role, not as head coach or as community leader, but how can I direct my kids in the same way my dad directed me? So we had three older kids, and then we ended up adopting a little boy when I was in Tampa in 2000. And we just knew that this was God bringing another person into our family. It was just perfect situation. So we followed that up 8 more times. And we now have 11 kids all together. I'm 66 years old. We've got a 6-year-old as our youngest one. So it does stretch people's imagination when they see us all together. But I really feel like I'm doing the same thing that my dad did, just trying to direct them, trying to guide them, trying to be there when they have questions, and trying to let them know that, you know what, you can do special things in this world. God's got special things for you. If you listen to him and follow him and work at it, but more than anything, if you'll submit to what he wants you to do, you're going to be in good shape. So that's the message I'm trying to get across to all of our kids.
Well, hey, you really inspire hope in me. You mentioned that you made your big pivot as a career professional at 53, and that number rings home real true for me right now at this moment. So just share with our audience, you know, what gives you hope? What brings you hope as we look forward? A lot of dynamics that we're dealing with globally and nationally and right here in our communities. around the pandemic, around the racial pandemic dynamics we have. Yeah. But what brings you, Coach Tony Dungy, hope?
I wrote a piece on social media after the George Floyd incident, and I said, hey, we're a divided country right now. We're divided racially, socioeconomically, politically. And the hope is, to me, is in Jesus Christ. The hope is that we as Christians understand what God wants, and that's to reach out and be welcoming to everybody and to point people to Christ and show people that, yeah, our human nature might be divided, but at the end of the day, we've got this bond that brings us together, and we can do it. So that's my hope, that people will respond. And I think people do respond. When you're reaching out, when you're friendly, when you're welcoming, it's hard for people to just shove away and push away. So no matter what, and that's something I learned from my parents, no matter how you're treated, if you respond in a welcoming way, that's usually going to draw people to you.
Yeah. Coach Tony Dungy, I'm so grateful for your time. You are a leader for good. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Glenn. Great to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Conversations On, where the YMCA of the North engages with local and national leaders, helping to inspire you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.